The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with a little fun stuff. How about some food? Many of us use this product now, and I'm sure you're all kind of familiar. What exactly is this stuff? What is margarine exactly? We have the scoop on what's actually in margarine and the surprising, fascinating story of how this butter substitute was invented. Here's an interesting piece of food facts trivia. Did you know that we have Napoleon III to thank for margarine? He offered a prize to whoever could invent a cheap butter substitute to feed the French army, and in 1869, French chemist Hippolyte Mergier-Mouat did just that and introduced the world's first margarine. So what is margarine exactly? Mergier-Mouat margarine was made by churning together beef tallow and milk. But when it began being mass manufactured in the 20th century, vegetable oils became the main ingredient. It may have been meant for the military, but margarine soon crossed over to the mainstream, becoming a popular grocery item all over the world. Margarine was considerably cheaper than butter, making it a good value for many working families. For people in hot climates who cannot refrigerate butter, margarine was able to stay solid at room temperature. Because it didn't burn easily the way butter does, it also became a popular one-to-one butter substitute for cooking and baking. And when doctors discovered that too much butter could be bad for our health, many people took the margarine as a healthy alternative. Well, things got a little murky for margarine in the 90s. Today's options are better than they've ever been before. What is margarine made from? All margarines and butter substitutes on the market have their own special blend of ingredients. But for the most part, margarine is primarily a blend of natural vegetable oils, with palm kernel, and soybean oils being the ones most commonly used. In addition to these oils, margarine almost always contains water and salt. After that, any number of additional ingredients can be added for consistency, color, and taste. Side note, though there are environmental concerns about palm oils, margarine is a greener choice than butter. In fact, research has shown that carbon footprint of butter is more than four times that of margarine. Ooh, that's interesting. For a product to be considered margarine legally, manufacturers must comply with the FDA Code of Federal Regulations, which specifies margarine as a food in plastic form or liquid emulsion containing not less than 80% fat. But that doesn't mean that margarine is plastic. In this instance, the word plastic refers to foods that are solid at room temperature. What's the difference between margarine and butter? Butter is a dairy product made from milk or cream. It must be at least 80% fat to be sold commercially, and the remaining percentage consists of water and milk proteins. Margarine, on the other hand, is made from oil, water, salt, and a few additional ingredients such as emulsifiers. It's flavored to taste like butter. Did you know there was a time when coloring margarine to match butter was outlawed in some states? But it usually doesn't contain any dairy products. By law, it must also be at least 80% fat, though manufacturers can get away with less by calling their product a spread rather than a margarine. When cold, butter is rock solid, while most margarines are softer and will spread easily. You can leave butter and margarine on your countertop at room temperature for a few days, according to the USDA, but you'll eventually have a problem with both. Butter will spoil and margarine will separate into its base components. While the margarine will likely still be safe to eat, it may not have the mouthfeel you're looking for, notes the Food Network. Warmer climates will expedite the issues for butter and margarine, so keep that in mind when deciding whether to refrigerate or not. When it comes to cooking, you can substitute margarine for butter and vice versa, though depending on the recipe, they may produce slightly different results. For example, when sautéing food on the stovetop, butter can easily burn in the pan thanks to its milk proteins. Margarine, on the other hand, is made of oil, meaning it has a higher smoke point and won't burn. In baking, margarine won't melt as quickly in the oven as butter does. This doesn't make a huge difference when it comes to cakes, but for cookies it means less spread, and for pie crust it can make a flakier dough. Is margarine unhealthy? Here's where things get kind of tricky. For most of the 20th century, margarine was touted as a health food, when in reality it was not. At the time, margarine was made from oil that had been hydrogenated with trans fats, which in 1990 scientists discovered are bad for heart health. Margarine went from being a healthy alternative to butter to an unhealthy, bad trans fat food that should be avoided. But times have changed. Margarine companies began reformulating their recipes to be healthier and free of trans fats, and in 2015, the FDA officially banned trans fats in all processed food made in the United States. Today's margarine is not the same as one we grew up with, and it's finally making good on its promise to be a healthy alternative to butter. All margarine recipes are different. There are margarines that add milk products for creaminess, some of which are 100% plant-based, and others that add special ingredients such as omega-rich oils and plant steroids or cardiovascular health. But at their core, modern margarines are made from plant-based oils that are rich in mono- and polyunsaturated fatty acids, which, according to the Mayo Clinic, can help reduce low-density lipoprotein, LDL, or bad cholesterol when substituted for saturated fat. If you're lactose intolerant, vegan, or have an aversion to dairy products, it's important to check the label before you buy margarine. If a margarine contains any milk or milk-derived ingredients, the manufacturer is legally required to print contains milk products onto the list of ingredients. And now another exciting food article. And there's a picture of a gentleman here with a big funny chef's hat on top of his head, and he's throwing a piece of a big platter of, I guess you would call it platter, and a big disc of pizza dough in the air. Looks Italian. Not only is pizza one of the most popular foods in the world, but it also has a fascinating history. Growing up 90 minutes north of Chicago, that's not me, this is the author, I first discovered deep-dish pizza as a teenager. It was thick, rich, ooey-gooey, and full of everything I loved. Well, call me a traitor in the Chicago versus New York pizza war, but 17 years in New York City has solidified my preference for a thinner crust. Don't get me wrong. I'll still demolish a deep dish and have a great appreciation for the sort of crust and topping variety the person who invented pizza probably never imagined. But since my Chicago days, I've come to appreciate the simpler things in my pizza-loving life. Given that I travel about 4 months out of the year, I'm lucky to be able to try pizza around the world, including in Naples, Italy. There I experienced Italian pizza for the first time. Unlike American-style pies that often come loaded with a dozen types of meat, cheese, and vegetables, the two-ingredient pizza I discovered in Naples was made with nothing more than a good dough and a great sauce. To answer your question, yes, it was delicious. But that should come as no surprise, considering Naples is the birthplace of pizza. As for the genius Italian who invented pizza, well, his or her identity is, much like the person who invented ice cream and the person who invented the hamburger, in a bit of a mystery. While the origin of the first ever pizza restaurant may never be known, there are some fun food facts about the dish that we do know. Where was the first pizza made? Though most people point to Italy when they think of the first ever pizza, historians agree that the dish has an even longer history, provided you define pizza broadly. Consider, for instance, flatbreads. Ancient Greeks, Romans, and Egyptians ate these topped with various oils and herbs. Even as far back as the 6th century BCE, Persians were baking flatbreads covered in cheese and dates, pizza toppings that would be at home in a modern artisanal pizza place. But pizza as we know it today started off as a sort of flatbread that was popular in poor sections of Naples, Italy. When was pizza originally invented? Historians haven't pinpointed the exact date for the creation of pizza, but they've been able to narrow down the window quite a bit. Tomatoes originated in the West, but didn't make their way to Europe until around 1500s, where they weren't initially embraced because they were thought to be poisonous. So pizza couldn't have come into existence until after that time. A book from 1799 narrows pizza birthday even further. It describes pizza as being a dough with tomato sauce and cheese, so we know it was invented by at least then. And thanks to an Italian census taken in the late 1700s, which listed a handful of people as pizzolas, pizza makers. In Naples, as we know, the dish was well enough known to give rise to a profession. Who invented pizza margherita? Like many of the greatest origin stories, the creation of this pizza is a little murky. One version of the story claims your favorite Friday night meal was created when soon-to-be King and Queen of Italy visited Naples in 1889. In an attempt to be sort of a queen of the people, the future monarch insisted on eating as the common folk did, and that meant pizza, the food of the poor. Margherita of Savoy summoned the preeminent pizza maker in Naples, Raphael Esposito, and tried several of his pies, one topped with garlic, another dotted with anchovies, and yet another covered in tomato sauce and sprinkled with mozzarella cheese and basil. The final pizza, which conveniently had the colors of the Italian flag, was her favorite, so Esposito named it Pizza Margherita after his future queen. Granted, some of these details can't be confirmed, and other versions of the state that Margarita was already the queen and tried pizza because she was bored with French cuisine at court. The former story does seem just a little too good to be true, but the establishment known as Pizzeria Brandi today still features a plaque pronouncing it as the birthplace of Pizza Margherita. When did pizza come to America? Pizza could be found in the United States as early as the 1910s. It's popped up on the East Coast and in the Midwest, places from Omaha, Nebraska, and Racine, Wisconsin. But if we're talking about where pizza became famous in the United States, then we're talking about New York City, even if it's not always ranked number one for the best pizza in America. While Lombardi's in Manhattan became the first licensed U.S. pizzeria in 1905, pizza historian Peter Regas says there's no evidence to confirm that it was the first pizzeria in New York City. He believes that pizzerias may have opened across the river in the borough of Brooklyn. Who invented pepperoni pizza? Unlike the origin of pizza, which can be traced back to Naples, the origin of pepperoni pizza couldn't be further from Italy. In fact, Italians frowned down upon pepperoni, which you'll never find as a topping in that country. Michael Harlan Turkell, host of the Modern Pizza Podcast, says the Izzo family began making the sausage in Canastata, New York, in 1906, and may have been the first to sell it to pre-sliced. But food historians believe it wasn't until the 1950s, when a pizza place in New Haven put pepperoni on a pie, that the spicy sausage became a pizza topping. Still, it wasn't a national phenomenon, at least not yet. The rise in popularity has Domino's to thank. Yes, that Domino's. It may not be America's favorite pizza chain or the best pizzeria in your state, but it certainly became a major player. In the 1980s, Izzo Sausage Company began making pepperoni for a small chain called Domino's, Turkel says. The rapid growth of Domino's Pizza, combined with the popularity of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon, firmly positioned pepperoni as a favorite pizza topping. According to Turkel, some statistics show pepperoni being used as a topping on nearly 50% of pizzas nationwide these days. How did Hawaiian pizza originate? Love it or hate it, Hawaiian pizza is sure to spark debate, and it's not just about taste. There's a dispute about its origin as well. You probably guessed that unlike Italian pizza, Hawaiian pizza didn't come from your local pizzeria by way of Italy. But you'll probably be surprised to learn that the dish, which is typically topped with canned pineapple and ham, but may also include peppers, bacon, and or mushrooms, doesn't come from Hawaii either. The sweet and savory pie is actually believed to have originated in Canada. Yes, Canada. According to the Modernist Piece de Book Collection, French-Canadian Sam Panopoulos is often credited, sounds like a Greek name, doesn't it, is often credited as having invented the Hawaiian pizza in 1962. But the authors note that the 1957 ad for Francine's Pizza Jungle in Oregon advertised an Hawaiian pizza topped with pineapple, papaya, and green peppers. Who gets credit for inventing it first? The early Oregonian version that included various fruits but no ham, or the Canadian version that may have pioneered what we now consider to be the standard Hawaiian pizza. You can be the judge of that. If the idea of chowing down on a pineapple-topped pizza is off-putting, go with a classic like green peppers, mushrooms, or eggplant, or pick a pizza topping based on your zodiac time. The next time you decide to order a pie or pick up a frozen pizza. And now for a total different subject, nature. Lighting up the night. Lucky visitors to the Great Smoky Mountains are treated to dazzling light shows, courtesy of a special breed of firefly, or lightning bug if you're from my part of the world. I've been in Great Smoky Mountains National Park for less than an hour when I'm mistaken for a woodland fairy. Even though I'm here to witness the ethereal phenomenon of synchronous, boy, that's a mouthful, ethereal phenomenon of synchronous flyflies, Photinus carolinus, a species famed for its ability to flash in unison, the association is surprising. After a pandemic period of virtual living, I'm feeling more like a haggard dweller of the modern world than an enchanted being. In fact, when I hear a stranger calling out from across the forest glen I'm wandering, it takes me a second to realize that she's addressing me. She waves me over and asks again, "Are you a magical creature?" The woman gestures towards the two young children with her and says, "We saw you walk down the river and then you disappeared. I told the girls you must be magical. This whole place is magical. Reminds me of Narnia or something." It does feel as if we traveled through the portal to another realm. The woman is sitting on a porch stoop, but there's no porch. and there's a chimney nearby, but no house. To reach a trailhead in an area of the park known as Elkmont, we, along with hundreds of other visitors, here to witness the synchronous Fireflies light show, which generally occurs in 2-week period around early June, had to walk along an avenue of mountain cabins, abandoned after the park was formed. Remnants of the former settlement are visible everywhere, scattered among river-rounded stones and beds of fern. In 2021, Tufts University released the first-ever comprehensive study of firefly tourism. Researchers found that globally, 1 million people travel to witness firefly-related phenomena every year. Given that the synchronous fireflies of Elkmont are some of the most famous firefighters in the world, and I live in their home region of southern Appalachia, coming across the study during lockdown made me think it was time to see these brilliant creatures. The firefly of Lynn in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which straddles this section of Tennessee in my home state of North Carolina, draws seekers from across the continent. Years ago, the National Park Service instituted a lottery for people to secure passes, since the species' growing popularity raises concerns about conservation. But even with these limitations, the annual gathering isn't a small one. I explained to the woman that I dipped down to the river for a brief respite from the crowd. The woman emphasizes, "It's hard to know what to do. Know what I mean?" Indeed, I do. It's been hard to know what to do for a long time running. Even mundane errands have, throughout the pandemic, required abstract risk assessments. And it doesn't seem that we've figured out as a society how to reckon with the magnitude of what we've been through. I'm seeking firefighters' bioluminescence, or living light, mainly because I've been spending too much time basking in the artificial illumination of screens. According to the International Dark Sky Association, 99% of the people in the United States don't have access to natural light anymore. Internationally, artificial light pollution is growing at a rate of 2% a year, with no signs of slowing. It's as if we, as a species, have grown afraid of the dark. Since the initial COVID-19 shutdown, I've stayed up too late, acting as if the light of the screens might stave off doom. I've fallen under the influence of phones, tablets, and computers. For several seasons now, I've been beating myself against the screens like a moth against a light bulb. Seeking entertainment that might numb me, news that might comfort me, and the process has only served to disrupt my animal instincts. Tonight, I'm hoping to break the spell that the screens have cast. Along the trail designated for firefly viewing, people have been setting up folding chairs as if they're waiting for a parade. They're a diverse bunch. They're 9 months old and 90-year-olds. Some of them have been to the firefly viewing several times. Others are awaiting the first synchronous firefly sighting of their lives. Firefly habitat is so specific, so mercurial, that it's possible to see a great show from one section of the trail, while another remains relatively dark. No one, not even rangers, can predict the best seats for the evening. So people mill around until they find a spot that feels right to them. Finally, dusk comes. For when the first fireflies appear, sporadically flashing, they don't seem, to my untrained eye, to be much different from the common species that illuminate backyards across the country. But as their numbers grow, expectant murmurs travel up and down the row of spectators. Instinctively, when hundreds of insects grow to be thousands, which appearing enlightened to one next to it, like a candle being passed, the crowd stands. For a while, the insects' rhythm remain a bit discordant, like that of an orchestra warming up. Scientists have found that the more individual fireflies participate, the more in tune they get. Before long, there are so many that it's clear they're working in unison. The effect isn't a lights-on, lights-off situation as I'd expected. It's more like watching a stadium wave. But members of the crowd successively lift their hands, swept into the fervor of something larger than themselves. The insects are responding to each other's light, working with their neighbors to find a role in the whole. From a distance, the activity appears as shimmering current running through the forest from right to left. Whoosh! Then darkness. Then again, a whoosh of light. I cannot see the face of the woman beside me, but I come to attention when she calls out, "Dun, dun, dun, dun," remembering the famous motif in Botticelli's Symphony No. 5. "It's like they're playing music," she says to someone beside her. Despite the awkwardness of approaching strangers in the dark, even more acute these days, when many people haven't seen their extended families outside of video calls, I pipe up, "Have you heard about how the synchronous fireflies were originally found here?" "Whoa, A messenger from the dark, she says, laughing. No, tell us. So I share what I've read. Len Faust, a naturalist who used to spend summers in the now-defunct Elkmont community, grew up admiring the fireflies we're watching. As an adult, she came across an article about synochronous fireflies in Asia, and she recognized similarities between what the scientists were reporting and what she'd seen as a child. When she reached out, researchers were skeptical that a species unknown to science existed in the most visited national park in the country. They asked her to imagine the flashing light as musical notes and record their rhythm on a blank speak of sheet music. Her efforts convinced firefly scientists that they should make the trip to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, where they confirmed the existence of a previously unrecorded synochronous species. This, ultimately, is how we all ended up in Elkmont, bearing witness to this evening. I can sense more people gathering around me as I'm speaking. When I finish, strangers' voices ping to my left, to my right, from the trail behind me. Their words ring like bells. Amazing, says a baritone. Fantastic, shouts a soprano. What exactly do you think they're singing, a man asks the crowd. Beyonce, all the single ladies, a woman says. Laughter ripples up and down the trail. Most people in attendance seem to be familiar with the concept of firefly flashes as a function of mating. The insects we're seeing are male, signaling to females to stay close to the ground. Scientists generally agree that the mating-related utility of fireflies' bioluminescence, but they've long tussled over how exactly fireflies make light. It's generally thought that illumination occurs when a firefly opens an air tube, allowing oxygen to ignite inborn organic compounds in its body. This means, in a roundabout way, that when you see a firefly light up, you're watching it take a breath. Collectively, the crowd gasps and sighs as firefighters flit through the forest. But despite the dazzle, I find my eyes wandering toward the infinitely dark ground, because once I started researching fireflies, I came across this fact. By the time we see a firefly in flight, it has potentially been living among us for up to 2 years in various life stages, dimly glowing on the ground. What we're witnessing now is the grand finale of a long-term metamorphosis. These famed fireflies have spent much of the past year crawling around in the dark to find what they elementally need to survive, so that their species might ultimately thrive. These creatures have been waiting for their turn to rise, and finally they found it. When people begin leaving the park, headed for their hotel rooms and tents, the fireflies are still working like cells of a glowing forest-sized lung. There are more than 2,000 known species of fireflies in the world, and 19 of those, with synochronous fireflies being the most famous, reside within the borders of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Will Kuhn, Director of Science and Research at Discover Life in America, a nonprofit centered on biodiversity, believes there are more. I don't think we've found all the firefly species in the park, he says. There's a chance we won't know what we've got even after we've gone. Globally, firefly populations are under assault, and the largest threats to their well-being, according to the Tufts report, are habitat loss, pesticide use, and light pollution. When I meet Kuhn, he's holding court with 24 people who've been signed up for a synochronous firefly viewing event hosted by his organization, which often partners with universities and other research institutions. Since the founding of Discover Life in America in 1998, the Duke has documented more than 10,000 animal and plant species in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and more than 1,000 of those were previously unknown to science. We're getting ready to travel down the mountain to Norton Creek, a private creek-sized habitat outside the park. Kuhn knows the area to be home to a large population of synochronous fireflies, which have now been observed in Appalachia and as far north as Pennsylvania. The group is already buzzing with questions. Many of them are here because they failed to win federal lottery passes. Given that they found another route to witness the synochronous phenomenon, they're already feeling lucky. One of the women encircling Kuhn says that she's excited for a good show, but she only has plain old fireflies on her farm in Ohio. Kuhn suggested that if she does a little research, she'll find that her region is likely home to several species, all with their own songs and longings. The most common firefly in the United States is the Big Dipper, but there are 150 species with specific habitats and behaviors in North America. Each of the bioluminescent species' flash patterns is as unique as a fingerprint. And where you find one species, there's a good chance you'll be able to find others nearby. Susan George, a nurse from San Antonio, Texas, lives in the city proper, and she's always been amazed that fireflies are tenacious enough to find homes there in rare squares of land that have been spared from asphalt and concrete. Sometimes when I'm sitting out in my yard, fireflies land right on me, she says. The woman from Ohio nods. When they do that, she says, it feels like love. The nurse gives a weak smile. I'm here because it's the hospital. I work with bugs of different kinds, she says. And after this year, I really needed a break. Everyone falls silent. We are, as any group of humans might be at this point in history, a swarm of loss embodied. On Norton Creek, we're seeking abundance. Unfortunately, when we finally make it to the waterway, the local population of Cynocrinus fireflies fails to greet us. There are only a few partnered dots of light. Predicting emergent states of fireflies involves a formula of temperature patterns and other factors, but even with careful calculation, the details of firefly metamorphosis can be difficult to predict. It's several degrees cooler here than it has been in Elk Mountain region of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. The Cynocrinus residents of Norton Creek apparently need a few more days to fully wake. Just when it seems spirits are irretrievably waning, someone spots a strange orb of light rising from the understory. It peers at us from across the creek, blue and unblinking. I've been familiar with the term blue ghost for years, as related to my home region's firefly attraction. Until recently, though, I didn't understand that Cynocrinus fireflies and blue ghosts were a different species. They have slightly different mating seasons, and these often overlap as conditions transition from evening to evening. Currently, on Norton Creek, it seems it's the blue ghost flies firefly population that's peaking. The ghost moves towards us, and it isn't flying, it's floating. Soon, there are carpets of light in and around the forest on all sides of us. These creatures, noted for their neon-bright color and enduring flashes, which hold up to 60 seconds at a time, are visible demonstrations of how to breathe deeply. Their traceable flight patterns make them look as though they're intoxicated. As a group members wander off, I find myself walking alone. But with every step I take, more flyflies reveal themselves. Blue orb fairies, hundreds of them, appear to be following me. They're swooping and swerving, then serenading me, not as a visitor in this landscape, but as part of it. I've seen the aurora borealis in the Arctic. I've witnessed migrations of the Serengeti, and I've snorkeled in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Yet I'm not sure I ever anticipated any national phenomenon more than this marvel of Appalachia. By the time I hear voices on the road ahead, I've lost all sense of time and space. In dim moonlight, I can make out half a dozen silhouettes in the distance. Coon's voice is hushed. People typically don't walk around the night without lights on, he says. But it's amazing what happens when you let your eyes adjust to the dark, when you take the time to really look. For weeks after I return from Tennessee, I find myself scanning meadows and creeks, not as a scenic backdrops, but as a habitat. Every plot of land I see is suddenly weighted with secret golden glory. And each night around 9:30, when I typically be logging into Netflix, I get the urge to go outside and check the local firefly population. The high country of North Carolina, where I live, is primed to become the next firefly tourism hotspot. In 2019, a population of Cynocrinus fireflies was discovered near Boone, North Carolina, on Grandfather Mountain, a beloved regional attraction. The entomologist who found this species during a nocturnal stroll taken on a whim has been traveling a trail I've walked dozens of times in the daylight. The mountain is closed to night visitors, but National Resource staff members are investigating how Grandfather Mountain might host future flyfire viewings without harming habitat. Surveys of Cynocrinus populations in the mountains have led participants to find previously overlooked Blue Coast populations in locales frequented by hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. Even my ordinary front door, on the far end of neighboring Watauga County, is a portal to a parallel universe once the sun has set. But it's taken the pandemic for me to recognize it. My guided night walks have acted as a sort of training. Even so, it still takes me a few nights of distant firefly watching to leave the familiarity of my front porch. This ease-in approach gives me an opportunity to correct the night population seeping from my house, mitigating trespasses against my bioluminescent neighbors that I hadn't been aware I was making. I close curtains and turn off porch lights. The difference made by these small changes is staggering. Incrementally, as the darkness around my house deepens, I move farther out. I take to sitting around an old chicken coop, watching what I now understand to be femme fatale fireflies winking from the treetops and big dippers plunging through meadows. One night I decide I'm going to leave my immediate environs to explore the valley beyond. I set out for a place where fields and forests meet. When I reach a neighbor's livestock gate, open since its last inhabitants, a family of goats, were killed by an unidentified predator, I pause, mustering the courage to enter. But before I embark on my chosen path, I hear a rustling in the feral pasture above me. My eyes are still adjusting. I use vestiges of twilight to trace the ragged outline of high grass. I'm on the verge of dismissing the sound as a manifestation of my anxiety when a wildcat flings itself into the sky. I see it, claw to claw, arched like a crescent moon, nearly close enough for me to touch it. The predator has pounced onto something I cannot see so quickly that I hardly have time to register what's going on. Then from the thorny bramble, the wildcat exhales in a guttural hiss. The sound slithers around for me, and I yelp from the pressure of it. I turn to run, but somewhere behind my conscious mind, I have a vague understanding that running would trigger the animal's prey instinct. It takes everything I have to slow my stride. I pivot to an unexpected route, keeping my pace steady. I target the yellow pool of a distant security light. Even I know the light cannot save me. That's when it registers. I might have set out on my firefly pilgrimage because I wanted to revel in light, but what I needed was a reconciliation with darkness. Fireflies are light bearers, but as the darkness between most species flashes, that revealed their true characters. Without intermittent darkness, there would be no synchronized light shows. There would be only glare. Stars are, after all, in the sky above us even at midday. But we see them only when the sun takes his leave. Because while it's true that only light can drive out darkness, there are some forms of light that only darkness can reveal. We live in an age that asks us to get comfortable with constant disruption. There will always be, as there always have been, threats beyond our line of sight. But as we venture into the unknown, we also stand to encounter wonders yet unimaginable. I keep walking. Half a mile from the site of my wildcat encounter, I slow my stride. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a lone firefly blinking in what appears to be a sinocular pattern. It repeats, but with a dark pause that holds, beat after beat. I cannot imagine that I found a sinocular firefly here, but I'm no longer willing to discount any patch of land in southern Appalachia. Slowly, entire constellations of fireflies rise from the cold black earth around me, twinkling with oxygen. I attempt to align with their rhythm. Inhale light, exhale dark. We are breathing at this moment in sync on this complicated planet, and even the decent parts of the mountain valley I'm standing in are pulsating with life, illuminated. The author of this article is Leanne Hinton, and I have to admit, that was got to be one of the most poetic articles I can remember reading recently. Really, really good. And with that, let us switch over to Consumer Reports. And from Marta L. Tellado, the President and CEO of Consumer Reports, the fight against PFAS. Our lives have changed during the pandemic, and we're only starting to grasp some of the less obvious impacts. For example, many of us stopped eating at restaurants and opted instead for takeout meals. In fact, 62% of Americans are now more likely to get takeout than before COVID-19, according to the National Restaurant Association. And aside from the sheer waste created by all those takeout containers, we now know that they could also contain potentially dangerous chemicals. You may have heard of PFAS, pronounced PFAS, short for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. These chemicals can be found in countless products, including nonstick pans and waterproof jackets, as well as takeout containers. They're linked to some serious health concerns, such as lowered immunity and various types of cancers. CR's test confirmed that some burger wrappers, salad bowls, and baking cups at popular chains and supermarkets contain concerning amounts of these chemicals. They're also in our water, with one study finding that more than 200 million Americans likely have PFAS in their drinking water. Another CR test found that even bottled water can contain PFAS. While we offer tips to help you minimize your personal exposure, you can't avoid PFAS altogether. What's needed for now is for companies to voluntarily stop using them in their food packaging. Our government should establish strong limits on their use, and consumers must speak out. You can start by signing our petition asking fast food companies to halt the use of PFAS in packaging at cr.org/PFAS packaging. and by calling on lawmakers to pass the bipartisan Keep Food Containers Safe from PFAS Act at cr.org/PFASAct. This year marks the 60th anniversary of Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, about the dangers of reckless pesticide use. Public outcry it triggered led to federal legislation that helped launch the Environmental Protection Agency. 6 decades later, let's take action on the next silent treatment of PFAS. Making cars more efficient. Drivers in the U.S. will save thousands of dollars and we'll all enjoy improved air quality because in December, the Environmental Protection Agency finalized more stringent emission standards for new cars and light trucks. CR was one of many groups urging the EPA to reestablish standards at the same level as those set in 2012, which were rolled back in 2020. We took the lead in providing data and analysis on the consumer cost and benefits of stronger rules, showing they would save consumers an average of $2,400 over the life of each new car, starting in 2026. We also objected to an early proposal arguing that it included too many loopholes for automakers. We submitted over 25,000 petition signatures in support of the stronger rules and rallied CR members to testify at public hearings. The final rule delivers almost all of what CR has asked for, putting the U.S. on a path to a 60% reduction in new vehicle greenhouse emissions by 2030 and saving consumers more than $1 trillion in fuel and maintenance costs, even after accounting for higher individual technology costs through 2050. What EVs save compared with gas-powered vehicles? Electric vehicles and fuel costs save 60%. In maintenance costs, they can save up to 50%. Update. Baby sleepers. In April 2019, Fisher-Price recalled almost 5 million Rock and Pay sleepers, triggered in large part of a CR investigation that eventually uncovered nearly 100 infant deaths linked by the product. But the records obtained by CR this year indicate that only about 8% of the recalled sleepers had been accounted for by the end of 2020. CR is now calling on Fisher-Price to redouble its efforts to get the sleepers out of homes. We are also pushing for legislation that will require companies to devote more resources to recalls and improve how they notify the public about them. Striving for safer food. What's at stake? Roughly 1 in 6 Americans get sick, 128,000 are hospitalized, and 3,000 die from foodborne diseases each year, according to estimates for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Careful food handling by home cooks can help, but food producers and regulators must do more to minimize harmful bacteria in the U.S. food system. How CR has your back. CR has worked long and hard to make the food you buy safer to eat. One of our tools is lab testing. In January, for example, CR found E. coli 0157/H7 in a package of Kroger-branded ground beef purchased in late December in Seattle. The discovery, part of our larger ongoing effort to test ground meat purchased across the nation, prompted a recall of 28,000 pounds of ground beef. No illnesses have been reported to date. More broadly, we're pushing to address regulatory shortcomings that put consumers at risk. One reason a recent beef recall was effective. In the 1990s, the Department of Agriculture declared E. coli 157-H7 an adulterant, a status that triggers an immediate recall if the pathogen is found. By contrast, poultry processors can legally distribute their products even if they're known to contain dangerous bacteria, such as Salmonella. So CR is urging the USDA to establish zero-tolerance policy for most dangerous strains of Salmonella. What you can do, follow best practices when handling meat and poultry at home. You can read about safety tips and sign up to get CR's food safety alerts via text messages at cr.org/foodmistakes. Now from Letters to the Editor. In our February article, How to Get the Sleep You Really Need, offered expert advice to getting your nightly rest. And CR readers chimed in with some smart sleep tips of their own. My trick for falling asleep is listening to podcasts about sports, as well as audiobooks on history and other nonfiction topics. I use comfortable in-ear headphones at a low volume, with an off-timer set for about 30 minutes. For me, Apple's wired ear pods block just enough sound and don't become irritating. That's Aaron Iskar in Honolulu. Don't count sheep. Instead, count backwards by 3 from 300. It requires some persistence, but I've had early, nearly 100% success getting to sleep or back to sleep. It's really amazing how effective this is in turning off an overactive mind. David Dornbush, Ithaca, New York. Your article on sleep was very helpful, but missed one important option, using meditation apps. I use a free one called Insight Timer, and I know there are others. If you go to sleep on the homepage, they offer a list of categories such as sleep music and bedtime stories. I use sleep meditations, which includes a wide variety of guided meditations that help slow my busy mind. I also use them to have trouble going back to sleep in the middle of the night. E. Patrick First, Moscow, Idaho. In your recent article, you had several suggestions. I tried and or used them all. I have an additional one I want to share that has been most important for me. Flipping my alarm clock down. When having trouble sleeping, I would often look over at my clock, which always made it worse. No matter what time it was, 2 a.m.? Man, I'm only going to get 4 hours, best case scenario. 4 a.m.? Ha, shucks. What's the point of even trying to sleep now? With my alarm facing down, if I wake up, I just tell myself that it doesn't make a difference what time it is. It's still dark out, and my alarm will tell me when it's time to get up. It's such a small thing that has helped me get out of my head. Kevin Lang in Denver. Earplugs and a sleep mask were not suggested as aids to assist some sleeping problems. Being a light sleeper, I experienced difficulty falling asleep and remaining asleep when night shift workers dictated sleeping during daylight hours. My apartment happened to be near a children's playground. One of my colleagues suggested a set of wax earplugs to block out the noise. I gave them a try and slept undisturbed all day. I have used them ever since and have tried many types, other types as well, wax, foam, and silicone. Robert Ketchison, Oshawa, Ontario, Canada. Dark chocolate. By the way, I just bought some dark chocolate. It's very good. Thank you for... Is dark chocolate really good for you? Highlighting the problem of exploitation in the cocoa industry, I refuse to buy major label chocolate brands that won't guarantee their cocoa beans are not harvested using child slave labor. I try my best to be a conscientious consumer. I try to be cognizant of what end results my purchases might be. Keep up the good work. Paul Evanson, St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I've heard dark chocolate contains caffeine, sometimes in significant amounts. I'm surprised this article does not mention that. I would like to see a comparison study of different brands. Joel Metzger. Editor's note, dark chocolate does contain caffeine, but in relatively small amounts. An ounce of chocolate with 7 to 85% cocoa has about 23 milligrams of caffeine. So a 2-ounce bar would have about 46 milligrams. Compare that with an 8-ounce cup of coffee, which contains about 100 milligrams. According to the Food and Drug Administration, most healthy adults can safely consume 400 milligrams of caffeine a day. Your article about chocolate did not mention any significant health hazards, but how significant is the heavy metal calcium in dark chocolate? Are cadmium worms valid? William Keller, Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Editor's note. Some research has found that dark chocolate may contain cadmium. A 2017 study by an FDA researchers found that an average cadmium level in the dark chocolates they tested was 7.7 milligrams micrograms per ounce. While there's no daily limit in the U.S. for cadmium intake, the European Food Safety Authority recommends no more than 1.12 mcg per pound of body weight per week. Based on the study average, a 180-pound person who ate 5 ounces of dark chocolate a week would be consuming 19% of the European weekly limit for cadmium. If you're concerned by that amount, consider reducing your consumption. I read with great interest your article on dark chocolate. I have preferred dark chocolate to 85% cocoa and higher for most of my adult life. My favorite brand was not mentioned in the ratings, Kroger Private Selection 85% dark chocolate. It's creamy with intense chocolate flavor. It's made in Switzerland using Rainforest Alliance cocoa. And best of all, it's $1.79 for a 3.5-ounce bar. Marion Hertz in Boise, Idaho. Better cell phone plans. In the February 2022 article, The Best Cell Plan Deals for Everyone, you did not mention that some of the Big D providers have better coverage in some areas of the country than others. That needs to be taken into consideration when looking at plans and providers. An example, in my area of the country, Verizon has a much better coverage than other two major carriers. Editor's note. Coverage can vary from place to place, so we recommend that you ask neighbors who use the service you're considering. If they're happy with the reception in your town, or better yet, invite them over for a cup of coffee and then ask them to place calls from inside your home to confirm that their provider's coverage is good. I would like to share one more option that has saved me money and other plans. Anyone who has Xfinity Internet is eligible to sign up for mobile service, Xfinity Mobile. On this plan, I have unlimited talk and text, and pay for data. Since my husband and I are on wireless most of the time, we can share data on a pay-as-you-need basis. This charge reduced our bill from $122 a month to an average of less than $18 a month for both lines. They also own limited data plan competitive with other carriers, Pete King in Conroe, Texas. Be more more accessible broadband. What about satellite internet? You say that 25% of the folks you surveyed and without a broadband connection state that it is not available where they live. Satellite is available anywhere. And I checked one source that prices it at $59 per month with no installation charge. Why should the government be shelling out money for something that is already available or competing with private companies? David Morgan, Southport, North Carolina. Editor's note. Satellite internet service typically has the lowest speeds and some of the lowest rated internet providers in our annual ratings of satellite companies, with generally worse scores for value, reliability, speed, and technical support. Satellite services suffer from interruptions from weather and won't work with VPNs or added security. It tends to be a last resort for people unable to get fixed broadband in their area. There's some hope that new low-Earth orbiting satellite internet, such as SpaceX Starlink, will improve this option, but right now it costs $499 to purchase the equipment, plus $99 per month for the service. Does decaf tea boost the same health benefits as regular tea? In the February 2022 issue, the Food IQ article on the healthiest tea for you, you caught my eye. I regularly drink tea but use a decaffeinated black tea to avoid the caffeine. Are there health benefits of decaffeinated tea similar to those of reduced regular tea? John Morrison from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Editor's note, decaf black and green teas have fewer antioxidant compounds than caffeinated ones, although they still have some. For example, decaffeinated black tea has about 80% fewer theoflavins and about 40% fewer theoarbugins, the main antioxidant found in black tea, than regular tea does. And decaf green tea has 62% less of the powerful antioxidant, EGCG, than the caffeinated version. What we're testing in our labs? We tested 50 models of bike helmets. For the helmet's ability to absorb the impact of a crash, how easy it is to adjust the fit of the helmet, and how well ventilated it is. The median scores were 71, the range was 31 to 85. The top score at 85 was excellent ventilation, zero reps, register MIPS at $65. Removable visor and washable inner padding, LEM Boulevard at 40 got an 81 score. Easy to adjust for fit, the Freetown Luminaire at $40, overall score of 80. Microwaves. We tested 77 mid to large size countertop models. We test for how quickly, quietly, and even it heats and reheats food and more. Median score was 66. The range was 33 to 89. Well, that's a big range. Panasonic NNSN77HH is $220, covered at 88. Very even heating from the Hamilton Beach P1100-43ALH at $100, got an 80. And sleek and quiet bargain was the Auster OGC-MDM at $100 and got a 74. The inside of my microwave has burn marks. Should I replace it? You may not need to. Burn marks happen when metals, including any utensils and even aluminum foil, are placed inside a microwave. That's because metals interact with the microwaves and can lead to sparks causing burns. Interestingly, turning on an empty microwave, which you might do by mistake when trying to use a timer, can also cause burn marks. With nothing inside, there are no water molecules to excite, so the unit can overheat, says Chris Ziesler, technical service supervisor at Repair Clinic, a website. Minor burn marks on the interior usually won't keep the microwave from functioning, but if you see a hole in the coating is peeling, it's time for a new unit. Smartwatches. We tested 27 models that work with iOS and Android. We test for how easy it is to use key features like the messaging and calendar apps, how well the display resists scratches, and more. Median was 77, range was 60 to 84. Easy to use and tracks 90 plus different sports. The Citizen CZ smartwatch at $395, scored at 84. Durable scratch-resistant screen, the Fitbit Versa 3 at $230, scored at 81. And nice price and long battery life, 14 days, the Amazfit GTR 2 at $150, also scored an 81. Insect repellents, and we're in that season, 37 sprays and pumps. We test for how effectively it protects against mosquitoes, whether it stains clothing and more. The median score was 58. The range was 4 to 95. Wow, what a range. Top-notch protection. Ben's Tick and Insect Repellent Wilderness Formula Pump, 3.4 ounces, $6, scored a 95. Good value. 3M Ultrathon Insect Repellent for 6 ounces, got $11, scored a 94. Wow, that's a big difference in price for the same benefit. Less likely to stain clothing. Repel Lemon Eucalyptus Insect Repellent, 4 ounces for $5, scored a 99. Solid wood flooring. We tested 11 pre-finished models. They tested for how well flooring resists dents, scratches, and fading from UV rays, how slippery flooring is when wet, and more. Median was 42, range was 35 to 71. Resistance and scratches is a T. Aragon Polifolio at 750 per square foot, scored a 71. Reduces slips at a nice price. Lumber Liquidators Bala Wood Character Red Oak, $6.30 per square foot, scored a 69. Doesn't fade in the sunlight. Hartco Paragon Original Ember SAK P95, 750 per square foot, scored a 68. Best Buy Strollers. We tested 25 traditional models. We test for how easy to use, including adjusting for safety harness, folding and unfolding, and how well it maneuvers and moors. The median score was 75. The range was 49 to 88. Top value and steers easily is the Bretax Be Lively at $250, scored at 83. And that's a three-wheeler. Narrow and lightweight Mountain Buggy Nano at 220, scored an 80, and that is a four-wheeler. Prices include an infant car seat attachment, Grabo Verb Click Connect travel system at $190, scored at $800. That's also overall a four-wheeler, but it does have the detachable car seat, which is kind of cool. They didn't have that when my child was young. Ask our experts. It seems like there have been a lot of food poisoning outbreaks from fresh produce. Is it safer to buy frozen vegetables? The overall risk of getting sick from properly handled produce, fresh or frozen, is low, says Sanjay Mohid, Ph.D., Manager of Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports. But those types have been involved in outbreaks of illnesses due to Salmonella, Listeria, and other bacteria in recent years. Produce can be contaminated at the farm during harvesting or while being packaged at a processing plant. And even though most frozen vegetables undergo an additional process of being blanched in hot water or steamed before freezing, they may still contain bacteria. Those at highest risk for food poisoning, young children, the elderly, and people who are immunocompromised, may want to cook their veggies, which kills bacteria. Staying informed can minimize your risk, too, says CR's Food Safety Alert at cr.org/food alert, which will send you text messages about multi-state food outbreaks and recalls. I've heard that at-home COVID-19 tests aren't accurate. Is that true? At-home antigen tests are quite accurate, especially if you have symptoms when you take them, says Nathaniel Hafer, Ph.D., an assistant professor in molecular medicine program at the UMass Chan Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. Though different brands of rapid antigen tests on the market have different levels of accuracy and can vary in real-world use, several are above 90% accurate when used by a symptomatic person, according to the test manufacturer data compiled by the Medical Letter of Publication for Physicians. The tests, however, are more likely to return a false negative if you're infected with COVID-19 but don't yet have symptoms. That's because the test might not detect the smaller amount of the virus in your body, typical of an early or warning or waning COVID-19 infection. When testing at home, keep your area's infection rates in mind, too. When COVID-19 infection rates are very low in your area, a positive test result on an antigen test is more likely to be a false positive, according to a 2021 research review. When COVID-19 is running rampant in your area, the risk is greater than a negative result on an antigen test is wrong. I'm sorry, result on an antigen test could be wrong. So if your antigen test is negative, but you think you've been exposed or you aren't feeling well, it's best to avoid being around others and consider confirming that negative result with a PCR test, which is highly accurate and usually takes 1 or 2 days for a result. Can I unfriend someone on Facebook without them knowing? When you unfriend a person, they won't be notified, but you'll disappear from their friends list and they won't be able to see your private posts. If you've been out of touch with that person, they might not notice, but they'll still be able to look up your profile, just like any other non-friend Facebook user, and send you a message or friend request, depending on your privacy settings. If you no longer want a friend to be able to see your profile or contact you at all, you can block them. That person won't get an alert, but they'll be able to figure it out pretty easily, says CR Tech reporter Ewell Grauer, because they won't be able to find your profile or message you. You won't be able to see the profile you've blocked. Keep in mind that you want to keep if you want to unblock that person, you won't automatically be friends again. You need to see a new friend request. If you're just tired of seeing a friend's post, you can prefer to unfollow them instead of unfriending or blocking them. Unfollowing a friend prevents that person's post from appearing in your feed, but that person won't know that you've been unfollowed. They'll still be friends on Facebook, so you can still view their profile and post them when you wish, and they can still view yours. To unfollow, click the three dots at the top right corner of the person's post in your news feed and select unfollow. CR Insights. Well, we're going to run a couple of these, but we're going to have to quit before we're through with it. But this will give you an insight of what we'll do next week. Spring cleaning may be way easier. Want your annual cleanup to be a breeze this year? Our experts share their favorite tools, all top recommended in CR Best Buys, giving you the most powerful anti-dirt arsenal for the least money. These products, picks, and quick tips will help you clean out that winter dust and debris from carpets, kitchen floors, patios, and more. And we'll be looking at vacuum cleaners, microwaves, different types of vacuum cleaners, the top box of chocolates. Why that has anything to do with cleaning, I don't know. Lost your phone, time travel organizing, a whole bunch of little things. But the top-rated Hoover is the Hoover Dower Dash Pet. Overall score, stained carpets. This cleaner scrubs a mix of water and detergent into your carpet, then vacuums up water and dirt. It removed red clay stains as well in our test, and at 17 pounds is lighter than many other models. And the Kenmore 200 Series BC400 at $250. This valuing sells at removing embedded dirt from carpets and picking up pet hair, one of the hardest things to banish. Plus, you can easily adjust the pile height with a foot pedal. And for pet hair, damper rubber gloves with tap water, then run over couches and curtains to pick up hair and lint. For smelly microwaves, to stop odors, add 1/4 cup of lemon juice to a small bowl of water. Microwave it high for 1 minute. Steam should fill the microwave, which helps loosen splatter stains, too. And for sticky fingerprints, tramp it a soft microfiber cloth with tap water to remove fingerprints from TV and phone screens, as well as stainless steel appliances. Rub gently in small circles. And the Toro top-rated vacuum is the budget-friendly Toro, works beautifully to clear away debris and grime from patios. It's a blower. It's easy to handle and has more than one speed setting for better control in tight areas. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time.